Welcome to Modern Practice. I'm your host, Dr. Tom Villanueva. And on this episode, Dr. David DeLoreto and I continue our discussion on lessons learned from COVID-19. David, so let's take our discussion from that of among us clinicians to actually looking at things in reference to staff and leadership, particularly with resilience. What do you think of programs, or what are other ways that we should be considering in reference to staff and leadership resilience?
Well, you know, our workforce has gone through a lot in the last 10 weeks, and many folks have not only had to move to, you know, home environments to work, but they're working under a lot of uncertainty as well. You know, and one of the unfortunate aspects of the pandemic is that in order to prepare for mitigating its spread, there was a lot of demand destruction of the types of services that healthcare providers were providing. So many of them have been sitting on the sidelines. And that's a really important issue to begin to address from a workforce standpoint. Are people getting the emotional support that they need? You know, we do know that, you know, anxiety and depression is on the rise. I think forward-thinking employers are giving a lot of thought about how to actually combine this work from distance and for some folks, relative isolation. And as we bring them back into the workforce, how do we support them? You know, the pandemic isn't over. There are folks who still will have aspects of how do I get the childcare that I'm going to need if my children can't go to school, you know, in some periods of time. Or I've got an elderly parent or loved one in my home and I might be safe, but I'm worried about asymptomatic spread when I go back home from the work environment. We have to give a lot of thought about how to support people in that type of work environment. And I know that leading companies, including fortunately our company, Vizient, is giving a lot of thought to that.
David, you and I are from the boomer generation, where all through our healthcare career, every time our organizations built something, people came. How important is it now to actually listen to the consumer voice?
This is one of the most encouraging signs as I'm talking to our health system members and those of you who are actually in the trenches right now. What I'm encouraged about is how you're thinking about conveying to people that the environment is safe, that we're here to help you, that we are a trusted source of information. And, you know, some of the things that you can do right now is make sure that you understand that people are scared. You know, what most information is showing us right now, about 60% of people, it ranges by age and by gender, but they're afraid of healthcare interactions right now. And so that actually has to be overcome. And some of the ways to do that, obviously, one is to make sure that your physician is involved, that a patient's physician is involved in these communications. And we're seeing that happening right now. Folks who were able to relax large-scale social distancing in the last 2 to 3 weeks and have been able to restart elective procedures, some of them are back up to 70 and 80% of their pre-pandemic utilization. A lot of that was through concerted efforts to do outreach and outreach with the patient's physician. And that's really important. The second piece of it will actually be showing people real graphic ways. What is it going to be like when you go back to the physician's office? You know, who will be able to come with you? Where will you park? What will that experience be like? And leading healthcare organizations right now are actually finding very, very good ways to communicate that. And then I think the third thing that actually is going to be very important is, you know, what are the other access channels that you could use now? We know that people want contactless services in some ways. And so this ability to integrate virtual channels into your care delivery is going to be really, really important. So designing around, you know, what patients and families are thinking about and what they want is really, really going to serve you well.
You mentioned about the importance about bringing loved ones into the hospitals or to the facilities. And many of our patients that we listen through different resources here at Vizient say that that's top of mind. Anything come to mind?
It is really important, and it's something that we need to make sure that we address. Whether you're going to be delivering a child and you want to make sure that, you know, you can have loved ones there with you, whether you're in a situation where your loved one may have dementia or behavioral aspects of dementia that are frightening for them to be alone. Those things, you know, have to be addressed, and we have to do it in a way that keeps people safe, but also, you know, recognizes these very important emotional connections when people get health care. And that's something to give a lot of thought to. And there's different ways to do it. Some folks are tapping into their advisory councils where they have patients and family advisory councils. Others are even going further where they've identified a cohort of people in their community, let's say 3,000 people, where they're going to measure consumer sentiment around healthcare services. And they're really studying how is that changing week to week and what type of feedback that we get. And, you know, through your Vizient membership, we'll be bringing these findings to you. And I think they'll be very important as you move into the, you know, the next stages of evolving your delivery systems in the face of an ongoing pandemic.
So many of our organizations, if not the great majority, were affected financially during this crisis, and lots of ways even devastated financially. And it just helps me think, is fee-for-service dead?
Well, that's something that we're trying to figure out right now. There's no doubt that the economic impact of the mitigation strategies that were implemented had a very, very significant impact on the healthcare sector. It's probably the in addition to other service industries, hospitality and transportation, obviously, the most significant impact. And there's some things from the past that we can think about as we go forward. One is that typically healthcare has been relatively recession-proof in the United States. Even in the deepest of recessions that impacted large sectors of the economy, healthcare, even though it was impacted, was not nearly impacted to the same extent. However, in those situations, we didn't have ongoing pandemic as well as deep recession. And so that's really one of the challenging aspects of this is that the public health measures that we move to now as we move from large-scale social distancing to surveillance, screening, testing, contact tracing, and isolation are still going to impact healthcare systems fairly significantly, and they have to be prepared for that. On the other hand, there is the opportunity to relook at fee-for-service medicine. Historically, and particularly in recent years, folks felt that, well, maybe that's less risky than other forms of value-based care. Right now, we know that fee-for-service did prove to be risky, right, in a pandemic situation where demand destruction actually happened to that degree. And at the same time, if we think about the last decade, in particular in the United States, where the Federal Reserve was actually managing inflation at about 2% per year, and most industries, their pricing models were actually able to be at that or less, there were two industries that weren't, that actually were significantly above it. One is higher education, and the other is healthcare. And so there is some risk as we move forward that the pricing models that colleges and universities used and healthcare use are going to be very different if folks are getting a lot of care and a lot of their education in new and virtual ways, right? It's hard to imagine that an MBA from the Wharton School is going to be priced the same way if 40% of the time you're going to be online. Much like getting an exam from a physician virtually is probably not going to be priced the same way. And so from a pricing standpoint, we'll have to think about that. We already have many of our members thinking and talking to their managed care companies now about looking into value-based care in new ways and locking in pricing in new ways. And we know that folks whose delivery models were much more oriented around value-based care, folks like Iora or Oak Street Health or ChenMed, who actually would accept Medicare Advantage risk, are actually doing much better under those models right now and managing well during the pandemic. And so I think it is giving people an opportunity to relook at value-based care in a new way, and also with this eye to a significant economic downturn where the pricing models that folks that in healthcare and universities in particular used may not be sustainable.
I couldn't agree more. I think that similar to what we saw with virtual care, this will probably accelerate value-based. And again, you can't possibly be successful in value-based care unless you actually have everybody work at top of license. So I think one thing may actually feed into the other.
Yeah, and the competitive landscape could change as well. So there are folks who had been thinking about this, particularly in the retail space. How do we provide better coordinated, much lower cost healthcare, particularly for chronic diseases? So folks like CVS and Walmart who are looking at pricing models that are very, very different, much lower cost, they actually could become either competitive threats or collaborators with you, depending on your capabilities and your view of the world.
Actually, it goes back to that thought process that you and I have been speaking about for last few weeks, which is the new norm. If you don't think in ways of the new norm, you're actually at a competitive disadvantage.
Yeah. And there's three things you can do right now with respect to that. And we're seeing it happen as people are sort of, you know, be able to catch their breath now and they're not worried about, you know, day-to-day PPE issues. They're starting to look at their strategic initiatives and they're saying, you know, where should we just persevere with an initiative? Where do we actually need to actually pivot from that for various reasons, most likely because the world changed? And what weren't we doing that we need to start doing now? And so rethinking strategic initiatives right now is where we're seeing folks start to have more and more conversations and doing scenario planning because of the volatility and uncertainty that's out there, making sure you're doing that planning under various scenarios. And there's sort of a formal process that we use to take management teams and boards through a strategic planning process under different scenarios. And that can actually help delever some of the risk that's out there in the future.
You know, COVID-19 further exposed our vulnerabilities to address social determinants of health. What are your thoughts behind that?
Well, you know, this is something, again, that we have been talking about and need to do a lot more, right? And we've learned a lot in the last 60 days, you know, particularly about this virus and who's susceptible and who needs to be protected. And there's no doubt that folks who have, you know, comorbidities and are aging are at very, very significant risk. And folks who are healthy and younger are not with this virus. And that's an important learning. And we need to translate that in two ways. One is, in the short term, as long as there is circulating virus and no vaccine and no effective therapies, we need to protect certain folks, you know, particularly the frail elderly with comorbidities and particularly those in institutionalized settings. On the other hand, we need to think about how do we actually decrease the risk of comorbidity for folks who are either developing early stage chronic disease. It's why I was so happy to see that, you know, the Medicare policy change this week that actually going to decrease the out-of-pocket costs for insulin for Medicare beneficiaries, because we know that, you know, that pricing and it's just been very, very problematic for folks. So there's much more we need to do from a policy standpoint. I think that, you know, that we'll get an opportunity to do that right now simply because, you know, we've learned a lesson about, you know, the impact of social determinants of health in a new way, you know, particularly with respect to vulnerability to complications of this infection.
We also saw for the first time, at least in this century, patients dying alone. I can't imagine this effect on patients, families, and also on healthcare workers. Any lessons learned there?
You know, Tom, this is something I hope we never lose sight of. The aspect of people dying and having to die alone is something that is not natural for human beings. And there's been probably an over-medicalization of death over the last 50 to 75 years because of the way that we've approached it. And as you talk to healthcare workers who were in the intensive care units and realizing that they were with people who weren't going to die with a loved one holding them, it had a very significant impact on those healthcare workers. They're telling their stories about that. Many of them would use their smartphones to conference in loved ones who couldn't be in the room. And there's probably, you know, it's just not in human nature to see a loved one die and know that they died alone. And so that's something that, you know, is really one of the great tragedies of this.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I can't imagine the effects that are going to be long-term, not only for patients and families, but also on our staff. So because of this, is the new norm cohorting patients? Many of our systems were actually placing patients on floors specific to a disease state. Now we're actually seeing it occurring because of an infectious disease process.
Absolutely. You were seeing it in hospital floors, right? And we're also seeing it in ambulatory facilities. Interestingly, during the, particularly in the surge periods, there were folks, some of you converted your urgent care centers to intake processes just for COVID suspects. Some of you actually had identified employees who actually had been exposed and were asymptomatic, and you actually arranged for them to work in those settings. So particularly in a surge situation, you know, that's something that many of you did and made sense. And it's something as flare-ups actually occur, hopefully not too many and not for very long periods, that may come back into play. The other thing we're seeing is in certain metropolitan areas, health systems work together to actually, as outbreaks occur, these little sort of mini flare-ups, it might be on a Saturday, 15 patients, let's say, who have to be admitted from two nursing homes, rather than all of them going to the nearest community hospital, they're actually in a rotation system, much like they would do with a multi-casualty trauma situation, and they rotate the admissions across, you know, health systems. And so those types of mitigation, you know, workflow issues are, I think, are going to help with the burden of outbreaks that could be occurring in the upcoming months.
David, thanks for taking the time for joining us today for the last two episodes. I appreciate the discussion.
Thank you, Tom. The pleasure's been mine.
And to our listeners, please join us for other Modern Practice podcasts on the Vizient Medical Leadership Channel. Subscribe today, like us, or send us your comments. Also, listen and subscribe to SG2 Perspectives, the podcast on the latest in healthcare strategy. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thanks for listening.